the spatial curvature, okay? And I'll talk about those today. But first, are there any other questions about the problem set or anything else that anyone would like to ask? Okay. So I want to start by just like reviewing a little bit from last time. And the main reason for this is just that the first few lectures in a cosmology class are so definition heavy that I want to just make sure that all the definitions are on the board. This lecture will also be a little definition heavy, but I think this should be the last one. So the FRW metric is defined like this, where A of t is the scale factor. And the stress energy tensor is where rho is the energy density and p is the pressure. And then some auxiliary definitions. The Hubble expansion rate is defined to be a dot over a, or the fractional increase in a per unit time. And the equation of state is defined to be the pressure over the energy density. And this would be 1/3, 0, or minus 1, respectively, for a universe which is all radiation, which is cosmologists speak for relativistic particles. Matter, non-relativistic particles, or minus 1 for the cosmological constant. Our universe today is like a 30% mix of matter and a 70% mix of cosmological constant, so RW is around negative 0.7. And one more definition. The astronomer's version of A is the redshift z defined by A equals 1 over 1 plus z. And redshift is very easy to measure. Like every time you look at a galaxy with a spectroscopic instrument, you get its redshift. And so observational astronomers and over time me have gotten used to thinking of z as just like a default time coordinate. So we analyzed, we did some GR calculations, which were largely exercises in specializing general machinery to this metric. And could take some calculation and derive some interesting equations. The continuity equation, which is the law of conservation of energy in an expanding universe, which let me write another way of writing this is like this. I write p equals w rho and bring the rho over, and then use the h to trade a time derivative for a log a derivative. So that from which you can sort of read off that the in a constant W universe, the density would go as a to the minus 3 times 1 plus W. So the instantaneous value of W, one way of thinking about the continuity equation, is that the instantaneous value of W is sort of setting the rate at which energy density has to dilute as the universe expands. Like if W is equal to 0, then as the universe expands, the energy density wants to go down as a to the minus 3. And then there are Friedmann's equations. This first equation is pretty easy to interpret intuitively. It just says that the total energy density, or rather its square root, drives the expansion rate of the universe. And then there's the acceleration equation, which is easy to forget about since you don't need it, strictly speaking. If you have the first equation and the continuity equation, it follows from those. But it can be relates the acceleration to rho plus 3p. Let me just, to interpret that a little bit, let me rewrite it as rho times 1 plus 3w. So that the acceleration equation says that the universe decelerates if w is greater than the magic value minus 1/3. When dark energy was discovered, or at least like conclusively established in the early 90s, the experiments that were being built at the time were thought of by most cosmologists as measuring an attempt to measure the prediction from GR of the of a decelerating universe. It was a historical surprise to find that the W of our universe, minus 0.7, was below this magic value and driving an accelerating expansion. The reason why there's so much theoretical bias for a decelerating universe is what today is called the cosmological constant problem. It's the statement that the cosmological constant in its natural units, M Planck, or M Planck to the fourth, is a number around 10 to the minus 120. If I had been around in the early 90s, or more accurately, old enough to have an opinion on the cosmological constant, I would have thought this was a pretty convincing argument. How could it be that there is a constant in nature, which in its natural units, the first 120 digits over zero, and then you're going to build this expensive experiment to measure the 121st decimal place and see something non-zero? Sounds a little far-fetched. But that is what happened. Lambda is, in fact, large today, and the equation of state is well below minus 1/3. And then we also talked about the Lambda CDM model and how its parameters are usually written down. In Lambda CDM, I'll write the Lambda CDM model just in a one-line summary, like this. It's just saying that the formula for the expansion, right? Or equivalently, rho is this without the 1/2, where the numerical values of the parameters are h naught, usually written down in these weird historical units. A more illuminating way of writing it is to say that 1 over h naught is 14 billion years. That's roughly the age of the universe and the basic cosmological timescale. And then the omega parameters are just the abundances today, or the fraction of the stress energy in each component. And I'm sure each of you have seen at least one talk which opens with a pie chart showing these proportions. One little detail here is that omega matter is usually split up as the sum of old dark matter component, around 0.26, and a baryonic matter component, which is everything else. Like, it really means standard model particles, including like electrons, which are not baryons. To talk about the expansion history, both cold dark matter and baryonic matter are non-relativistic throughout most of the expansion of the universe, and so it's not necessary to distinguish. And so I've lumped them together. We talked about how you would integrate Friedmann's equations to in the Lambda CDM model to determine the expansion history of the universe and, you know, compute things like distances as functions of time. And write that in this compact way. But if I suppose that you know, I'm working in some sort of context where rho or equivalently h is some specified function of A. Well, that's true in the examples so far. But I would like to comment that, you know, that's not guaranteed to be true. And just as a concrete example, when we talk about the physics of inflation later in the class, I'll consider a situation where the stress energy is coming from a scalar field with an equation of motion, which you can't solve in advance to determine rho as a function of A. Rather, you just have a different situation where you have to integrate for A and phi and rho at the same time. But with that little comment aside, so one nice way of writing the expansion history is to write dt is 1 over ah, and then, dA over a. And then if you think of the expansion history is specifying time as a function of A, then you can always write the solution formally this way. There's another, like, in this situation, there's another cartoon way of thinking about it, involving an analogy involving balls on ramps, which I do not claim is a deep analogy, but it's useful for drawing pictures and figuring things out quickly. So in this situation, I also claim that that Friedman's equations can be written like this, are equivalent to this pair of equations. And showing this as one of the Homer problems. The first equation and the second, that one you don't need any calculation to see is equivalent, but the second one needs a little calculation. So when written in this form, you can see that Friedman's equations are equivalent to integrating the trajectory of a particle. Just a particle moving in one dimension on a potential, let's call it V effective. A squared rho with a minus sign, and energy zero. Meaning the kinetic energy, A dot squared over 2 plus the effective. Like, you can imagine the initial velocity has been tuned so that the total energy is zero. So for example, sounds worse every day. We should have like a betting pool for when it's going to break. So for example, in Lambda CDM, where the energy density consists of these three terms, then I'm going to draw this picture. I'll say the effective potential, or minus a squared rho, I'll have a term that like minus a to the minus 2. Minus a to the minus 1. Minus lambda a squared. So here's my picture. I start off growing as a to the minus 2. And then there's a long period where it goes as a to the minus 1. And then with minus signs. And the cosmological constant takes over at some threshold value of the scale factor, and it starts to fall off as minus a squared. Now, if you imagine like firing a ball up this ramp, then it's whose energy has been tuned to zero. Then it's easy to see intuitively that there'll be sort of a slow period of deceleration corresponding to the period in the universe's history when the universe is growing as a decelerating power law. And then you suddenly like roll off this cliff and start exponentially expanding. Now imagine that I flip the sign of the cosmological constant. Now the potential is going to look like this. This is an example where this is helpful for quickly figuring out what will happen. Then your intuition about balls and ramps will tell you that what will happen is that the ball will go up, and it'll reach this point where its velocity is zero, and then it'll roll back down. And that describes a bouncing universe that begins in a big bang, expands to some maximum scale factor. The maximum scale factor is just the size when the negative energy density halts the expansion. And then it bounces and collapses to a big crunch. I didn't mention it before, but Friedman's equations describe a contracting universe just as well as they describe an expanding universe. Friedman's equations of motion are time symmetric. The equations of motion either involve a dot squared or a double dot. We're just usually interested in situations where the universe is expanding. So we just choose initial conditions where a dot or equivalently h is positive. I think, you know, if you, without this picture, it's like not totally obvious that the universe bounces as opposed to, say, stopping here. If you were just staring at Friedman's first equation, you might think that just staying at this point where h equals zero is a solution. The point is that Friedman's second equation would demand that a double dot is negative, and you have to start back down the ramp. Just like if you roll a ball on a ramp, it can't stop at a place where the slope is non-zero. There's a force pulling it back. This notation, B effective of A, is used in the problem set. And there's some other examples in there, but you'll get to sort of appreciate drawing this picture and figuring out how cosmologies bounce.
What is the sign of lambda for this case?
This case would correspond to a negative cosmological constant. Meaning that the vacuum energy is negative. Because of the minus sign in the definition of V effective, that puts a term in V effective of the form plus lambda a squared.
So negative cosmological constant corresponds to negative curvature or positive curvature. I usually get confused. When we write the action for Einstein-Hilbert action, we write R minus 2 lambda, right?
Oh, which way does the sign go in the Einstein-Hilbert action?
Changing this lambda gives us is which one, positively curved or negatively curved? If we talk about dissenter or anti-dissenter.
So in my metric convention, positive lambda would correspond to positive curvature, and negative lambda would correspond to a negative curvature.
So bouncing would be considered with negative curvature.
That is right. Yes. It's reversed with the other metric signature, which is why I just have to think about it. Okay. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk about is conformal time. We wrote the FRW metric and using proper time E, since the Big Bang is the time coordinate. And there's another time coordinate which sometimes comes up, which is the conformal time tau. Defined by the statement that E tau is dt over A. So conformal time is a clock that runs fast in the past and slow in the future. Or equivalently, conformal time is the integral of dt over A, since the Big Bang. And one thing that's interesting about that time coordinate is that if I write the metric, if I change variables from t to tau, then this looks like Minkowski multiplied by some scalar function. An overall scalar function appearing in a metric is sometimes called a conformal metric. So the FRW spacetime is sometimes called conformally Minkowski or conformally flat. A related property of conformal time is that get this picture up. Last time, showing light cones in the FRW cosmology. And the conformal time has been defined to straighten out the light cones, so to speak, and put them at 45-degree angles. Conformal time is a useful time coordinate for thinking about problems involving like causal structure or light cones. Now it's only interesting that there's this change of coordinates which will make causal diagrams or light cones look just like Minkowski. But you shouldn't overinterpret the statement. Like, for example, if I were to draw the trajectory of a massive particle or a time-like geodesic here, there would still be the Hubble friction effect that brings it into the rest frame, unlike Minkowski, where the trajectory would be a straight line. And there's, of course, other observable physics like photons redshifting. So for example, in conformal time, sorry, in proper time, the age of the universe is one number, 14 gigayears. Maybe it would be a useful comment to say that put it over here. The way you would calculate that is by integrating dt or dA over ah of a. But the size of the universe, or the co-moving size, is a different number, which turns out to be around 46 gigayears. That happens to be 14 gigaparsecs. So it, by coincidence, ends up being 14 either way. That's just the integral of dt over a, or the integral of dA over a squared h. There are these two integrals involving the functional form of h of a, which turn out to both converge if you integrate down to a equals 0. Over here in conformal time, the way this would look is that so this distance has to be the same, because we didn't redefine the spatial coordinate. It still has to be 46 gigayears. And so the conformal age of the universe is also 46 gigayears. Conformal time is just the what you get if instead of using proper time or like ticks of a watch as the clock, you use the co-moving distance that a light ray would travel to define your clock. The main usefulness of conformal time is just sort of technical. Like some calculations just are more conveniently done in conformal time. As an example, like the Klein-Gordon equation or the equation of motion for perturbations of a scalar field just has fewer terms if you write it in conformal time, which is why when we get to the inflation part of a class and use that equation a lot, we'll just use conformal time as the time coordinate for most of the calculations.
When we talk about the size of the universe, is that the number we talk about, the co-moving distance? Or?
Yeah. So I think you just have to be careful to define what you mean. If I talk about, I guess what I would mean by default, if I say the size of the universe, it would be the, you know, the maximum or the size of the observable universe. I guess what I probably mean is just the, you know, amount of universe that we can observe on our past light cone, but converted to a co-moving distance today. And that number is the 46 gigayears.
Confused. So the distance, the x coordinate where the two light cones intersect would be, I mean, the distance between them would be the coordinate distance, and then you convert it into the co-moving distance.
Oh, yes, right. Like if you were to ask a different question, like a moment after the Big Bang, what physical distance is this? Well, then it's zero or a tiny number, depending on what you. So you just have to be careful to define what you mean. In this drawing, I was defining it to be the co-moving size of the observable universe, or the distance that it would be today. It's easy to get somehow like distances and times in the expanding universe are more confusing than you might think. In the later part of this lecture, or if I don't get to it, the early part of next lecture, I'm going to draw some more observational scenarios on the board where it's not so easy to figure out what the proper notion of distance and time is. Next, I'm going to say a little bit about spatial curvature. So this is the one piece of physics in the expansion history that I didn't introduce yet. I wanted to kind of walk through the structure of Friedman's equations without introducing this detail. I want to start out just explaining like informally by picture the scenario that I want to describe. So far, we've been talking about the flat FRW metric, where the geometry of space is just a flat Euclidean geometry. But another possibility that you could imagine is that the universe is compactified on a sphere. That would be a situation where the spatial curvature of the universe K is positive. Zero spatial curvature doesn't mean zero spacetime curvature. Like even in this flat case, then because of the expansion of the universe, there will be components of the four curvature which are non-zero. And there's a possibility which less intuitive than a sphere, but it turns out that there's a negative curvature analog of the sphere, hyperbolic space. I'll try to draw like this. I'll define this properly later. For now, I just want to say that it exists. And you might wonder why we don't consider more general possibilities for compactifying the universe, like a torus or something. And the reason is that these are the, so that's totally a possibility, like that's a logical possibility. If we want to preserve the symmetry of the FRW metric, we want to have six continuous symmetries, then it's a theorem that these are the only so-called maximally symmetric possibilities for the spatial metric. So this is a reasonable place to start from the observational statement that there don't appear to be preferred directions in the universe. Now, all three cases are described by the following metric. I'll write it in a few lines. So by writing down this metric, I'm defining what the parameter k means. I'm separating out the definition into a few lines because it'll be sort of useful to have these intermediate quantities. So the FRW metric, you know, it still looks like a scale factor A of t squared times a spatial metric. And I've chosen to write the spatial metric in spherical coordinates instead of Cartesian coordinates. If k is equal to zero, then it would just be dr squared plus r squared times these angle factors, the usual spherical coordinate representation for the metric. And the curvature parameter just appears, you know, only in this denominator. That's the only change in the metric that's needed to describe spatial curvature. What's not obvious is that this form of the metric corresponds geometrically to what I drew in these pictures. This form of the metric also obscures the symmetry. Like, out of the six symmetries that I said each of these spaces have, only three symmetries are manifest in this metric, the rotations around the origin. But in fact, in all three cases, the space has as much symmetry as flat Euclidean space. I'm going to explain next time why those statements are true. And move on to writing down Friedman's equations. So the parameter k appears in Friedman's first equation like this. That's the only change. The continuity equation and Friedman's second equation turn out to be unchanged. Okay. So I'm going to talk about curvature in two passes. First, I'm going to assume that these statements are true. That is, I'm not really going to motivate the form of this metric. I'm not going to try to write down Einstein's equations in this metric and arrive at the first Friedman equation. First, I want to just sort of go through and explain what's different if you make these changes. From a cookbook perspective, it's not a big change. You're just introducing one new parameter in Friedman's first equation. And then I'll come back and properly derive things in the next lecture. Okay, so the first thing you'll notice is that curvature acts as a If I were to move the curvature term over to the other side, curvature behaves as a component of the stress energy with W equals minus 1/3. So that the energy density goes to zeta to the minus 2. And because of this minus sign, positive curvature contributes, I forgot to draw the row here. Positive curvature contributes negatively to the expansion rate and slows the expansion of the universe, whereas negative curvature increases the expansion rate of the universe. Now, when the way that you usually see curvature parameterized, for example, in observational papers that report constraints. Let me just write a write the parameterization of H of A. And with a new parameter omega k. The astro way of thinking about this is to treat the curvature on the same footing as an energy density by defining a fake energy density with this minus sign, which is easy to forget about, and then defining the abundance parameters to be the densities relative to rho plus the fake rho k. Curvature is a very well-constrained cosmological parameter. The try to say something about why the constraints are so good, but not till next time. The way the constraint is usually quoted in terms of this parameter omega k, it's sub percent, meaning that curvature, if present, is small enough that its effect on the expansion rate today is well below 1%. A more physical way of thinking about this, if I convert to omega k back to the parameter k like this, is that I think of the curvature as like something with units of co-moving distance to the minus 2. So that in the spherical or positive curvature case, for example, a spherical universe is allowed by the observations, but only if the radius of the sphere is larger than 77 gigaparsecs. Meaning that if you were to go around the whole universe and come back where you started, you would need to go 2 pi times 77 gigaparsecs. So much larger than our current, than the size of our past light cone, which is around 14 megaparsecs. Okay. had mentioned this, like, I'm going to draw some pictures of what would happen if you took our Lambda CDM universe and added some positive or negative curvature. Our first comment is that with this modification to Friedmann's equations, it's still true that Friedmann's equations are equivalent to this 1D particle system. I think this analogy is not very deep. Like, you can probably do something like this for any second order differential equation, although maybe it's not so obvious that there's no friction term. It's just that, but if there's curvature, then be effective rather than being minus a squared rho. Now it gets a term proportional to a with a plus sign.
Is that a on the left hand side, a double dot by a or not?
Oh, yes, thank you. Thanks for catching that. Okay. So, and this is what you would guess if you just, took the row that we had before and then added the fake astronomer's row curvature, which has k coming in with a minus sign and 1 over a squared. Okay. So, now if we're in our Lambda CDM universe, we're thinking of the expansion history of the universe as like rolling a ball on this ramp. And here's what we have without curvature. Minus a to the minus 2, a to the minus 1, and minus a squared. Now, if I were to introduce a little bit of negative curvature, it wouldn't affect this picture qualitatively. It would just push the potential down. So I guess the universe would get to its lambda-dominated exponential expansion a little bit faster because there would be more of a gap here. If I introduce some positive curvature, then at first nothing happens. I guess as you get close to zero, there's a period where the expansion history like sort of stalls for a bit before it gets going again. And then if I make it larger, I introduce enough positive curvature, I end up in this case, where the universe never makes it into the lambda-dominated phase before the positive curvature stops the expansion and makes the universe bounce. There would also, by the way, be another solution over on the other side where the universe starts out contracting, starts out with a large scale factor and contracts, and then gets down to some minimum size before it bounces and re-expands. So the universe would look like this. In between, there's a region where the a range of scale factors, which is just forbidden by Friedmann's equations, because h squared would have to be negative in the equation, so I don't have the solution. Now, an interesting historical cosmology would be one where the universe is tuned so that it touches zero, and the potential has there's this unstable point where the ball can sit forever, and this threshold case that separates the two possibilities is what's called the Einstein static universe. And I'm gonna write down. It's a universe with positive lambda, positive curvature, and some matter and or radiation. Where the abundances have been tuned so that there's some value of the scale factor, where in pictures, you know, have a local maximum at V effective equals zero. Or in equations, both A dot and A double dot are zero on both the left-hand side and right-hand side of Friedman's equation. So that's a pretty fine-tuned scenario. And has the following interesting history. This is what Einstein called his greatest mistake. When he wrote his equations down, the idea of a Big Bang and an expanding universe was so philosophically unpleasant at the time. Now I guess we've gotten used to it. He sort of searched hard to avoid the prediction of an expanding universe. And this is the scenario that he came up with. If you introduce just the right amount of positive curvature and a positive cosmological constant, then you can get the universe to stay at a constant scale factor forever. One problem with this picture, which is sort of obvious with historical hindsight, is that it's an unstable equilibrium. So if you perturb the universe, then something unstable happens. Like if you have a region of the universe where the matter density is a little higher than average, like the parts of the universe potential wells where structure forms, then or a little less dense than average, then you'll go one way or the other in this curve. And so an Einstein static universe is just a really unstable place where if you put in a perturbation, it either collapses to zero size in a big crunch, or it is dilute enough that the cosmological constant can take over and make it expand exponentially. In an Einstein static universe, you would not see any redshifting effect if you look out at distant galaxies because the universe is not expanding. And of course, what happened a few years later is that the expansion of the universe was discovered observationally by Hubble. Einstein said his greatest mistake was failing to recognize the prediction of an expanding universe.
What did you write? Something plus R is greater than zero?
Oh, matter plus radiation.
Oh, thank you.
You can think in Einstein's original version, he just had matter. But you could really have any combination of matter, which would be an A to the minus one term, or radiation, which would have an A to the minus two term, and still get this. Okay. I've got 10 more minutes yet left. I want to start.
Can we just discussing this diagram a little more? Is there like does the curve span t? Means as time goes forward in our universe, if we think about that in the beginning, you said that it is a power minus two. Which would be radiation dominated.
Yes.
So means the static universe case is means then there is no curve at all. That's at just that point.
The static universe case is just what you would get if you took our universe. I think of our universe as like coming very close to this curve because there's this long period where you're matter dominated, where you're getting closer and closer before the cosmological constant takes over. And then you add just a little bit of positive curvature, spatial curvature, to push it up so that you're just touching V effective equals zero.
So but that means even when Einstein calculated things, he should have seen that in the beginning was expanding.
Like how would you get here? Yeah, right. So if you started in a Big Bang, then you know what would happen is you'd roll up this curve and you'd never quite get there. It would take you like infinitely long to asymptote to this value. And I think my understanding of the history, which may be more complicated than my understanding, is that he just didn't want to use those initial conditions. He just posited that the initial conditions of the universe were such that it had always been at that point. Okay. Now I want to. So that's sort of a cookbook description of spatial curvature, how it appears in Friedmann's equations and how it affects the expansion history. Now I want to talk about the geometry a little bit more. I'm going to start by just getting some. Intuition for the spatial metric. I'm going to forget about the time coordinate for a bit and just talk about this metric. Euclidean three-dimensional metric. Okay, so imagine exploring this metric from the perspective of an explorer that starts out at the origin of the coordinate system and does some experiments. The first experiment that they might do is starting at the origin and going out to coordinate radius r and measuring the distance with like a physical ruler. And I'll call that distance traveled chi. So chi is the physical distance to radial coordinate r. And the way you would calculate that distance is you would integrate dl, or the square root of this metric. So I'd integrate dr over the square root of 1 minus kr squared. From 0 to r. Just for completeness, I'll write this, I'll write down the answer. The point is that it's just something which is not equal to r. Except in the flat case. Okay. And another experiment that they might do is to measure the circumference of the circle at radial coordinate r. We'll call that C, physical circumference. At radial coordinate r. So that would be, that's also given by integrating the line element, but now around the circle. So for concreteness, first let me write this out. Let me take that to be a circle that goes from theta equals 0 to theta equals 2 pi at a fixed value of phi. So I'm just integrating r d theta 0 to 2 pi. That's 2 pi r. So an explorer in this geometry would experience curvature as the statement that
in these coordinate systems, theta is from 0 to pi only. It's in the spherical coordinate, the way we define things.
Oh, yes, yes. The spherical, the angular part is supposed to be the same as in flat space.
Yeah, so, but I'm saying the coordinates that we define here, does theta go to 2 pi?
Oh, yes, yes. I forgot to say that. When I wrote down this metric, what I meant was that the angular part of the metric would be the same as flat space.
Yes.
And then
write down spherical coordinates, we don't have theta. Theta is the angle from the z-axis that goes from 0 to pi only, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, maybe it would be a little more,
maybe
it'd be a little better to make this phi integral, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that would be a little better. Yeah, and sine theta is equal to, if it's the equator, sine theta is equal to 1. Okay. An explorer in this metric would experience curvature as the statement that the circumference of a circle is no longer 2 pi times its radius, or r is not equal to pi. Is what happens, if we go one dimension lower and pretend that we're going from flat to space to a sphere where we can draw a picture. An explorer who doesn't know that they live on a sphere is doing some experiments. They would notice if they go far enough, like to exaggerate it, let's say they go almost all the way to the South Pole. They would notice that the circumference of a circle that they measure is smaller in the case of positive curvature than you would predict based on the radius that you need to travel to reach the circle. Okay. This in 59 minutes, so this is probably the right place to stop. There like a question or two before we stop for today? Okay.
So for k positive, we would have the physical circumference to be something less than 2 pi chi, and for negative curvature, it would be more.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right. You can see from the expressions that in the case of positive curvature, the circumference is less than 2 pi r, and for negative curvature, it's greater than 2 pi. Or 2 pi chi, I should say.
Normally, people use k plus minus 1 and 0, but you just use it for positive, negative values.
Oh yeah.
It's kind of convention that people use.
Different authors do it differently. Sometimes when talking about these spaces, in some books they take k to be one of these three discrete values. I just prefer to make it a continuous parameter. Any more questions? Okay, I'll see you. The next lecture is Monday at 9 a.m. Gong, I assume that the word ran out. I'm sorry about that. I have some travel and I had to move the lectures around. But we'll all suffer through it together. Also next week on Tuesday and Wednesday, my colleague Neil Dalal is going to give the lectures. But then after that, it'll be back to me for the rest of the course.
Thank you.